A 48-plus-year veteran of the broadcast industry, Jay recently retired from Harris Broadcast and rejoined the company on a part-time basis as a technology advisor. He is a former member of the Board of Directors and Vice Chairman of the ATSC. He has also chaired the Open Mobile Video Coalition Forum and served on both the FCC Media Security and Recovery Councils. In his current role at Harris, his focus is on ATSC Mobile DTV, Mobile Emergency Alerting, the development of new television broadcast standards and regulatory and spectrum issues. Jay also chairs the ATSC Mobile Emergency Alerting System Implementation Team. Jay is a SMPTE Fellow, a member of the SBE, and IEEE Broadcast Technology Society. He was the 2013 recipient of the National Association of Broadcasters Television Engineering Achievement Award. Jay holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Communications and a Master's degree in Educational Communications from Xavier University, Cincinnati, Ohio. Please welcome Jay Adrick.
Thank you very much. We're going to focus on a topic that I think will be near and dear to all of the TV broadcasters' hearts, at least in their near future. So we talked earlier, or heard earlier, about the National Broadband Plan. The National Broadband Plan came out in March of 2010, and it called for 500 megahertz of spectrum between 225 and 3.7 gigahertz, of which about 120 megahertz of that spectrum was going to or proposed to come from the television broadcast band, UHF TV band. And of course, 120 megahertz at six megahertz per channel, we're looking at something like 20 TV channels that we would give up. And 20 TV channels in a world where we have 51 channels today is a significant amount of spectrum. So the broadband plan proposed an auction, actually two auctions. One, a reverse auction where the broadcasters would give up their spectrum based on hitting an amount that would be palatable to allow them to either go out of business or to pair up with another broadcaster and share a channel on a channel sharing basis agreement, or to move from UHF to VHF. The little bit of civics lesson here very quickly. The FCC is, as you know, is an independent agency, and they report to Congress, so there's oversight both in the House and in the Senate. And most regulation is based on essentially two acts, the COM Act of 34 and the Telecommunications Act of 96. So there's a lot of industry lobbying that immediately went into gear right after the broadband plan was posted. And that lobbying came from various industry organizations, from manufacturers. Our company was certainly very vocal in the process. And the messages were all centered around essentially four things. That there's great value in local broadcasting, that broadcasting is a technology innovator. And that couldn't have been more apparent when during this process the mobile DTV technology was being rolled out, the mobile EAS technology, et cetera. There's a reliable and sound infrastructure from broadcasting during times of emergency, and that's been proven in most recently in Sandy, and out in what's happened in Oklahoma and many other places around the country where the wireless technology went away and the broadcast technology remained. And finally, there's a growing use of over-the-air television. While it may not seem like a significant amount in terms of percentage, in actual numbers, it's fairly large. Just in the past year, it went from 17% to 19% of the homes in the U.S. that primarily rely on over-the-air television for their delivery of their television service. So we spent a lot of time on the Hill. We got to know a lot of people in Congress and a lot of people at the FCC. The authorization for the broadband plan wasn't part of the broadband plan or the actual act that came out, and that did not occur until 2012, when we had a congressional act known as the Middle Class Tax Relief Act, or Tax Relief and Job Creation Act, but by the broadcasters it's more commonly known as the Spectrum Act of 2012. And that act authorized the FCC to move ahead with the auction process, with the repacking that would follow the auction process, but it placed significant safeguards on the broadcasters, basically tied the hands of the commission from the things that they had proposed to do. So what are some of those safeguards? Well, first of all, participation in the auction is entirely voluntary. You can't be forced to participate. Stations may elect to share a channel, and if they do, they retain full must-carry rights. No station is going to be forced to move from UHF to VHF or from high-band VHF down to low-band VHF. Stations forced to move to a new channel will be compensated, and notice the word reasonably. We still haven't fully defined that, but we're well along the way. And the cost will be pulled out of a fund of $1.75 billion that's been set up by Congress to fund this activity. And the FCC shall make all reasonable efforts, again, one of those weasel words that we have to be very cautious about, efforts to preserve the coverage, area, and the population served by a licensee. Commission may conduct only one auction. They can't run the auction, find out that it doesn't work, and then go back and try it again. The FCC must enter into international negotiations with Canada and Mexico. Certainly, I think in this area, you're within the 200-mile to the border zone, and there are many, many stations and many areas where the spectrum's really needed where they fall within that 200-mile border situation. And the entire process, the reverse auction process, must be completed by 2022. Okay, so the commission put out an NPRM last October, and they originally wanted comments due in December, but that got extended, and it was all about defining the auction eligibility, the proposed compensation for relocation. It asked a lot of questions, proposed general auction rules, and proposed a repack time of 18 months. So from the time the reverse auction ended until every station had to pick up and move to a new frequency, every station that was affected had to move, they wanted to give 18 months. And that was kind of a ridiculous amount of time, which we'll see here in a bit. The NPRM specifically limited the compensation to full power TV stations and Class A's. Low powers, translators, boosters, those are all a non-protected class of licensee, and if they were required to move, it was on their nickel if they could find spectrum. That was the basis of going forward. So there is a great deal of possibility that in many markets, low powers, translators, boosters will not be possible because the spectrum will not exist. The docket proposed a realignment of the 600 megahertz band, and this was a unique approach, not designed by the Media Bureau, by the way, designed by the Wireless Bureau, and it called for having an uplink spectrum that was at the top end of the 600 megahertz band, followed by a guard band, followed by a group of TV stations, followed by the Channel 37 carve-out for radio astronomy and medical use, followed by a downlink group of channels or spectrum, and then a guard band, and then the TV channels. And this was living in the dream world of 120 megahertz that would come out of the TV band. So what's wrong with this plan? We'll see here in a couple of minutes. They also proposed another little twist, and that was that the lower end of the band be different in different markets, depending upon the amount of spectrum that might be needed for wireless. And they did this with no real understanding of propagation that takes place in those frequency bands. So the industry quickly responded to that. They object, first of all, general response to the NPRM, but they objected to the split band plan that basically served no useful purpose. They opposed any broadcast assignments in what's known as the duplex gap, which was the gap between uplink and downlink for the wireless guys. They wanted a uniform band plan that avoided possible co-channel interference problems between services. They wanted fair and equitable compensation if they're forced to relocate. And above all else, they stressed that 18 months was an absurd amount of time and that they really needed something that was at least 3 years, if not greater, to be able to do the repack. The alternate band plan suggested by both broadcasters and the wireless industry came back in what is known as a down from 51 solution, meaning that at 698 down, we clear spectrum out in the repack, and that spectrum as a block goes to the wireless guys with no gaps, and then we pick up below that with the broadcasters after we have a guard band, so we avoid the current channel 51 problems that exist today with the 700 megahertz folks. So again, this was unanimous by the broadcasters and unanimous by the wireless industry. But that did not necessarily put rest to the FCC's plans. So we filed a number of comments that were coordinated with our customers and coordinated with the industry as a whole, particularly through the National Association of Broadcasters. And I'm not going to read every one of these, but if you can take a quick glance, they were all pretty much in alignment with what I think most broadcasters would state. In particular, we were very, very adamant about the fact that the 600 megahertz band plan should be contiguous, should be uniform, the guard band should not come from additional broadcast allocations. And one other unique area that we filed on was that this is a great opportunity to solve low band VHF issues. Take that spectrum, move the stations in low band Vs up to high band Vs because there's plenty of spectrum available to that, and carve up that spectrum, giving at least two TV channels to an expanded FM band. That was part of our filing plan. So in October of last year, they had the first of a series of repack, or what they call learn workshops. And somehow I got drafted to not only participate, but also give an opening statement. And my opening statement centered around the things that broadcasters should be compensated for if they are forced to move channels. I also put out a very stern warning about the fact that 18 months is entirely too short, even 3 years is probably too short, and pointed out that there is a hard limit on the amount of antenna work that can be done given the number of qualified crews in the U.S. that exist today to be able to change out antennas, and in some cases actually have to do tower work that's beyond the antenna change out. So what kind of compensation did we talk about, and how does the compensation work? Well, first of all, many, many broadcasters were vocal about the fact that they shouldn't have to fund this out of their pocket and then be compensated. So the plan that was presented was go out as a broadcaster, go out and get hard quotes from your selected suppliers, submit that block of quotes, get 80% back immediately from the government to fund the project. At the end of the project, take the actual invoices, sum those up, look at the difference between what you were given up front versus what you would actually have paid, or what you actually paid, I should say, for the project, and then get a true up at the end of the project. And the question was asked, well, what if there are insufficient funds? Do the guys who file late for compensation get penalized, and the guys that went early come out whole? Well, the answer was no. There's got to be a way to true that up. But more importantly, it was the job of the industry and the FCC to go back to Congress and say, look, you were told it was a $3 billion fund that was needed. You gave us $1.75. You forced this on us. You've got to pay the rest of the bill. Okay, here's the list of things that we were in sync with on the NAB. I actually took the list to the NAB group, and they spent quite a bit of time with us in making certain that everything was covered. A lot of things that, like legal services and so forth, that normally would get overlooked, we tried to get in there, as well as cleaning up and removing older equipment. So the FCC had their second in the Learn series of workshops in May of this year, shortly after we had the NAB show. And this was really hosted not by the Media Bureau, but by the Wireless Bureau. And this is where we found out where the band plan was created. It was created by the wireless guys. We have no understanding of high power transmitters and how high power transmitters and low power adjacent devices and receivers are going to get along with each other. And there were 27 invitees that were present in the panel. Most were wireless carrier, cellular receiver manufacturers, base station and associated equipment guys. There were three of us that represented the broadcast industry. It was Victor Towle. Many of you know Victor from his days at MSTV and then later at NAB. Myself and Preston Padden. Preston is the former president of the ABC network. He is chairing a coalition of 70 broadcasters who, or should say 70 stations that have decided to at least try their hand at the auction to see what they might get for their properties. So the three of us were representing the broadcast industry. And during that, we again proposed the fact that it needs to be a down from 51 band plan. We talked about co-channel spacing, a lot of other things that were cited, but everyone was in agreement, except the FCC engineers, that putting TV stations, high-power TV stations, in the duplex gap was a recipe for disaster, for intermod, for interference to television service from the wireless devices, because you know wireless devices might be two or three feet away from the antenna on the receiver as you walk around, that this just was not going to work. And I've never seen such a group of engineers scramble and try to defend their proposal in front of a fairly well-educated panel. There was quite a bit of discussion about co-channel spacing if we were to have these staggered band plans. And it was amazing. Most of the people from for example, AT&T and Verizon, the bigger wireless carriers talked about 200 kilometer spacing as being adequate. They got to one particular small carrier and they proposed, oh no, we can live on a co-channel basis on a 50 kilometer spacing. If you can imagine 50 kilometers away from a megawatt and trying to run a wireless base station, these guys have not a clue. We also talked about co-channel spacing, by the way, between broadcast stations, and I gave them one quick real-life experience. We have a very close friend who has a home up on Lake Erie out on an island. I helped him put up a Rhone tower, 35-foot tower. We've got three Yagis, because this is an area that's not served in the primary coverage area. We've got three Yagis, one pointed at Toledo, one pointed at Detroit, and one pointed at Cleveland. Well, if you follow the lake from Cleveland and you keep going, eventually you end up in Rochester, New York. And typically every fall, I can turn on the TV set, do a scan, and watch Rochester TV coming down across the lake, 323 miles from their transmit antenna to our receive antenna. So again, no understanding of ducting and the propagation problems that occur at those frequencies. So immediately after we got done with the workshop, early May, the Wireless Bureau issued an NOI on May 17th to gather more information. And what appears in the NOI? But the same old band plan with the gap and the staggered ends. So they're great listeners. So anyway, once again, they got a very stern response from both the wireless industry, from the broadcasters, in this case the NAB and Harris, responded to the NOI on behalf of the industry and said, guys, this will not work. Go back to down from 51. So a number of different comments filed. This was part of the actual statement, and went on to tell them that the record makes it crystal clear the high power TV operation in the duplex gap is problematic for both the TV viewers and the wireless operators, and went on to explain why. There's an oh, by the way, all of this is going on at the upper end of the band. In certain markets, TV channels 14 through 20 have been for years reallocated for public safety activities. And as part of the 700 megahertz activity, those services are supposed to move out of the TV channels to the 700 megahertz spectrum. So instead of the commission saying, well, gee, that's great, now we'll allow those channels to be reused for the TV repack, their plan is to put them up for auction for other services. So not only do we have the attack going on at the high end of the band, we've got an attack going on at the low end of the band in the markets that are listed. So it's going to be an interesting process here over the next few years. A couple of articles I've been writing that show up in Broadcast Engineering on behalf of the industry, and this is a series of articles that will continue. I think the next one's slated for January of 2014. A long list of unknowns. How much spectrum are we really going to get? The wireless guys have already discounted the 120 and said we're not going to get that. They think on the best possible scenario, they're going to get 84 megahertz. That's what they believe. We've done some studies looking at The number of stations that have decided to step up to the plate, around 70. We don't know where all of those stations are. We don't know if they're in markets that can actually contribute to where spectrum's needed. Many of them are probably Class A's and not full power. So there are a lot of, again, unknowns there, but we think that they'll actually be lucky to get 36 megahertz of spectrum. This particular chart shows you how many stations would have to go away in order to get number of channels, or I should say the channel number. In this case, the spectrum, 84 megahertz at the top of the chart. So as you can see, to get 84 megahertz, there would have to be something in the neighborhood of 550 stations that would be impacted. And that's a lot of stations. This doesn't take into account, by the way, any secondary relocation. So let's say your station went up for auction and your station had to move down the band because you elected not to participate in the auction, but Dave's station also had to move because there was a ripple effect in the repack. So there's going to be a lot of secondary moves that will be driven by the primary moves. Okay, so what will be the impact on each station, on their unique equipment needs? Over what period of time will the channel change process occur? What triggers the start date? What's the end date after that? I've got a good friend at the FCC who happens to be working on this. He's a lawyer, and he tells me there's some ways to game the system by not having the reverse auction officially end until a certain date, which would buy time for the broadcasters. Is it an 18-month or a 3-year transition period? We still don't know that yet, although I think the commission's beginning to get the picture. How will the channel change process? This is not an overnight process. You know, we did this for those of you who really have gray hair, but you probably weren't working in broadcasting. You were probably watching on black and white like I was. You would remember that we went through this back in the very early 50s, that many, many of the stations that were on the air in the early 50s on VHF moved to accommodate a repack to get more channels into the band. And that was not an overnight flash cut. It took a couple of years for the process back then to occur. So do we do this by a region? Do we do it by a DMA? Do we do it by auction markets? Do we start in the middle of the US and work to both coasts, or start at both coasts and work towards the middle? These are all things that still have to be determined. Is the compensation fund adequate to fund all expenses of the impacted stations? So we know the number of stations, we probably don't have an answer to that. Will the revised OET69 software preserve the station's current coverage area? Did a seminar for some key customers last month, and we brought in a well-known expert, in fact, the fellow who wrote the original OET69 documentation and software, and he went through about 2 hours of explaining all the variables, particularly since the FCC has gone in and updated the software to their advantage. So the answer to that is there could be some population equality, but not necessarily coverage equality. In the process. So will stations volunteer? This is a great question. We know that by recent articles that there's money been spent to acquire Class A and full power stations with the idea of profiting from the auction. So are these stations in markets that will make a meaningful contribution? The focus is on the top 25 to 30 markets. It's not out in the middle of Iowa or Kansas or places like that. So we're looking at, you know, at markets where, like New York and LA and Boston and places that really need the spectrum, at least they were told they need the spectrum. And there are many, many TV stations. New York, for example, New York City has 27 licensed TV stations. So think about the effects of none of those going away and repacking those to gain spectrum. Okay? So Preston Padden represents a coalition of about 70 stations, and these are kind of, we think, split by his own admission between Class A and full power, but no indication of where they are. Here's a, this was out of one of the trade journals, and talking about the fact that there are trading of properties going on with the hope of benefiting from the auction. So the FCC has proposed various ways to look at the value of a station. Factors like measured viewership, network affiliation, market size, and revenue generated. Again, are these in the top 25 to 30 markets or adjacent markets where giving up spectrum would help in the repack? And that really triggered an outrage, if you will, from the Class A and the guys who thought they were going to profit that have been selling their properties, saying, well, wait a minute, my 6 megahertz is worth just as much as your 6 megahertz. You know, I may be a Class A station in a small market, and you're an NBC affiliate in a large market, but we're still 6 megahertz. You know, mine ought to be worth just as much as yours. So that has actually caused some people who were thinking about jumping into the auction to rethink that process. So here's another view, and this news release talks about the fact that none of the network affiliates have expressed any interest at all in participating. And by the way, the proposed goals of all this was not only to generate spectrum, but we're going to pay down the national debt out of this. And I went through this workshop, and there was a guy who represented a watchdog group over the FCC. And he actually has a blog called Making Sausage at the Commission. And he stood up at the end and looked right at the Wireless Bureau guys and gave them a very stern lecture about the fact that he thought, in his analysis, that not only was it not going to contribute spectrum to the wireless guys of any great consequence, but it was going to cost the Treasury instead of putting dollars into the Treasury. So it was a pretty foreboding view of what is likely to happen. Okay, so what's the current status of the rulemaking? Well, there are bits and pieces emerging. We've got a revised OET 69 that came out in July. We have a task force update that came out in August. There was a webinar on repacking on August the 22nd, and since Linda made me get my slides in early, I couldn't mention another one in. September the 30th, there was a workshop, another LEARN workshop, and it was focused on compensation. So some FCC insiders, this was before they went home on sequester or whatever they're on right now, believe that a rulemaking document will be released before the end of October, and other ones are saying, gee, if it makes it before December 31st, I'll be surprised. And I would tend to agree that one is probably the thing. I know it won't make it by the end of October. So let's look at kind of the broadcast industry view of repack. These are the issues. How to remain on the air during a channel change? Are you going to, you know, have someone come in and dial in a new frequency in your transmitter overnight, and you just suddenly you're on a new channel? I don't think so. It's going to be a lot greater process than that, and probably will result in the fact that you end up with a new transmitter and probably a new antenna on top of the tower and probably, well, definitely a new mask filter and maybe even new transmission line, if depending upon what channel your line's optimized for and whether it can be reused on the channel that you're given. Some stations may have a second transmitter. Will that be covered in terms of the change? How about tower structures that might have to support a temporary antenna? Earlier today we heard about 222G, and if indeed you start modifying towers, there's an issue of whether or not the tower, if it doesn't meet 222G, whether your insurance company will insure it during the changeout. So you might have to beef the tower up before you make the mods. So that's a factor. Okay, addressing local zoning laws, there's a lot of push that came out of the September 30th panel discussion about having the ability for the FCC to override local zoning and local permitting so that there's nothing to hold back on the modifications to both the buildings and the tower. Engineering considerations related to modifying building and tower, again, will it cover a station with two transmitters, or in some cases, there are stations with a main and an alternate site. Will it cover both sites in terms of compensation? Limited number of qualified tower crews, we'll talk more about that. Limited number of technical crews to retune existing transmitters or install new ones. Manufacturing capacity. We had one of those moments when Dielectric announced they were closing their doors, and they're a prime supplier of both antennas and channel filters. How to deal with and compensate stations when there's a common antenna facility involved, because many times you have band stop filters in your transmission, your RF transmission system, that are for another station on the tower. And if they move and you don't, are you going to be compensated to put new filters in your RF system? how to deal with and compensate stations located on a common antenna? Okay, I mentioned that already. Industry-wide, well, there are 14 tower crews. And if it takes an average of 5 weeks, including travel, for a tower crew to change out an antenna, and they work 52 weeks per year for 3 years straight, no time off for bad weather, no time off for illness, no time off for vacation, the maximum number of stations that can be addressed is 434. That's it. Well, when we went to the workshop last year, the wireless guys said, oh, that's no problem. Go out and hire subcontractors like we did. Okay, and there was a guy from PBS in the audience, and he stood up and he said, oh, you obviously haven't seen our Nova special that we had on what happened in the wireless industry when they went out and hired a whole bunch of kids that just got out of high school, and they were ill-equipped to work on 200-foot towers, and how many of them were killed because of not having the proper instruction and the proper tools and the proper supervision. And then you're going to put them on a 1,000-foot stick or a 2,000-foot stick with an antenna that's not something you hoist up with a, you know, manila rope. Okay, so there's some technology impacts here. So as we go down in frequency to have an antenna of equal gain, the antenna's going to get heavier and it's going to get bigger. Is that going to work on a tower that was designed for an antenna that was lighter? So that may be a problem. It may be that you have to go to a lower gain antenna and raise transmitter power to get equal coverage. There are regulatory issues. Again, 3 years from completion. Is that really going to work? And then there's the international treaty issues with Canada and Mexico. Canada, the dialogue has started. Mexico, nothing started yet. And the industry brought this one up. I was in the room last May at the ATSC annual meeting. Bill Lake, who heads the Media Bureau, was there. And many of us said, you know, why don't we combine this with the opportunity to migrate to ATSC 3.0? And the answer came back, oh, no, we can't do that. We're in a hurry. Well, 3.0 will be ready as a standard in early 2016. So it could be one of these dual efforts if they were only just stop and wait. And if you really got into things, you would find that there are some advantages to 3.0 that would help them in repacking. But a real deaf ear was turned to wanting to listen to what those advantages are. You know, I'll throw out you could brand me as being heretical, but ATSC 3.0 will be a scalable physical layer. And you're going to have HEVC encoding, which is 4 times as efficient as MPEG-2. And the wireless industry is looking at our spectrum and their current spectrum in 5 megahertz blocks. We could give 36 megahertz back and not lose a single station. If we migrated to a new physical layer, our channels became 5 megahertz instead of 6 megahertz, and we could still deliver more content than we're delivering today over that same pipe. Okay? Also, by deploying a main stick and what we'll call a booster model, which is likely to happen with many stations anyway in ATSC 3.0, we could raise the DDU ratio between co-channel assignments. So today, where we've got co-channel assignments this far apart, we could probably move them to this far apart because we wouldn't interfere with each other because the average signal level across the contour would be higher. Okay, again, a help in repacking. But again, we have an FCC that's unwilling to listen or to wait. So why is transmitter technology likely to be replaced? You can't stay on the air and move a transmitter around, and if you have, you know, only have one transmitting device, you're not going to change it overnight. But oh, by the way, technology has advanced since the transmitter that you have was put in service. So today we can deliver, or at least in a very near future, we can deliver solid-state transmitters that are every bit as efficient as MSDC IoT devices, depressed collector IoT devices, are today, in a much smaller footprint and at a price tag that is equivalently the same, but no longer requires a very skilled engineer that knows how to replace and tune up tubes. You're down to modules that are very reliable, and you have a transmitter that's based on a modularized architecture instead of one device or two devices in the final RF path. Why couldn't you just say, okay, I need more power to make up for the OFDM to ATSC, the single carrier peak to average power difference, approximately 2 dB. And the answer to that is that many of the devices that are out there, many of the transmitters out there, are banded. This is just an example based on the Harris Diamond module, but this is true of most of our competitors' power amplifier modules. Here shows the banding and the staggered differences in band across the module because of circulators and PA modules being differently banded. So in order to add modules, you'd have to go out and build new modules, but in many cases, the solid state devices that these things are built around have gone obsolete. And companies like Harris and others have a sufficient supply to carry warranty support through a normal period of time, but but not enough devices in stock to be able to start building new modules to plug into an old transmitter and to start swapping modules around. So again, this is a factor that would drive the replacement of the transmitter versus the addition to the transmitter or the modification of the transmitter. We looked at data that we have on stations, and we said, okay, how many stations fall in the category of, well, we can do a change within the technical limits of the existing transmitter and antenna, and just basically dial in a new frequency and put a new mask filter in, versus how many stations are beyond the technical limits of the existing supported transmitter and antenna. And then the third look was channel change beyond the technical limits of the existing but unsupported transmitter. And keep in mind that there have been two major transmitter manufacturers that have gone out of business since the digital TV conversion. So there are a lot of people that have transmitters that for which there's no support. Okay? So we came up with something less than 5% of the stations fell into the we can dial in a new frequency, put in a new mask filter category. About 40% were in the range of we could modify the transmitter and change out the antenna. And 55% of the stations fell in the category of there's just no way we could use the existing plant, the existing hardware to make that change. So this is a quick run through of what the things are that would get done in a least impact, the less than 5% category. The moderate impact, you start doing quite a bit more. And the more likely scenario here, where you're removing the transmitter or converting it to a new channel as a backup and installing a new transmitter. And I call it an almost worst case and then a worst case scenario where you're literally building a new site. So very quickly, this is kind of the end of the process here. The FCC recently gave their update. This was back on August the 9th. And they said, gee, we define the repacking process as this. And the key components for that repacking are OET69, having that out, and providing coverage and interference calculations with supporting data. And they talked about the new method, the new software with the same methodology, and went on to try to defend the changes that they made. They talked about updates to adhere to the statute, preserving coverage area, preserving population served, and how they modified the OET69 to do that. I'm going to skip through a couple of these. This was the public notice that updated people on what's going on with the international scenario, as well as the fact that the new TV study software is out there, and they provided descriptions on how stations could be assigned or reassigned to a particular channel. And then they provided domain files and interference paired files. What were their next steps? To host a webinar on repacking resources. That's been done, and release additional repacking information to the public. Hasn't been done. And working with the industry on planning and reimbursement, they started that with their latest workshop. They're going to hire a long-term fund administrator, and they're going to review preliminary findings on the cost models, the timing, and the logistics. They went out and hired a company called Widelity to do some surveying, and Widelity has made some preliminary reports back to the commission on what it's going to take to repack. So That's pretty much the story. It's one of those moving trains that you have to keep up with all of the new data that comes out on a very periodic basis. And the story gets more interesting as the train moves further down the track. Questions?
I'll try to keep it short. We're talking East Coast, West Coast, where the cellular providers are looking supposedly for more bandwidth. We're already at, what, a 98% saturation of cellular users across the country. Do they have that any problems with overloading and things out there?
Well, Gary,
what are they going to do with this additional bandwidth?
Gary, if you'd quit watching TV on your cell phone, we'd solve this problem.
Yeah.
So you're part of the problem.
Yeah, right.
Hi, Jim.
Okay, real quick. How much distance do you think they're going to want between the Channel 14 or the T-band that they clear and adjacent markets?
Well, that really depends, I guess, on what services would move into that. And by the way,
if it's land mobile that's moving in.
Well, we don't know that it's land mobile. Nor do we know that, for example, all of this spectrum that we give up in 600 megahertz is going to end up with the major wireless carriers. It depends on who bids. And if you look at the commission's activities, you know, they actually were discouraging the Verizons and AT&Ts from going after that spectrum and looking for smaller services to come in and bid, which again is kind of a fallacy because the small guys aren't going to be able to pay the big bucks to offset the price of the TV spectrum, right? So, you know, on one hand they're saying big guys don't bid, little guys bid, but oh, by the way, we want maximum dollars.
Because the clear the 14 through 20 has a big impact on markets like Madison, Milwaukee.
Right. So again, until we would know who would move into that spectrum, I think is it narrowband services? Is it wideband services? Are the modulation waveforms compatible with coexisting against today 8VSB, but tomorrow OFDM when we go to ATSC 3.0? Those are the unknowns.
And real briefly, look in yesterday's Wall Street Journal Marketplace. There's a technology that uses TX and RX using the same spectrum, same frequency.
Okay, that you say that came out yesterday?
Yes.
Okay, I'll look for it.
Okay, thank you, Jay.
All right.